It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Here's how a lot of mortgage brokers make money. The bigger the interest rate on a loan, the higher their commission. In a few days, new federal rules will change that. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
Say you're buying a house and you go to a mortgage broker for a loan. The broker arguably has an incentive to steer you into a higher interest rate. Now, there are many mortgage brokers out there who don't do this, but let's say you qualify for a 5% interest rate. If instead the broker tells you, well, the best they can get you is a 6% or maybe even a 7% interest rate, and you don't shop around and you take it, the broker makes more money.
They basically received a kickback from the lender.
Ira Reingold heads up the National Association of Consumer Advocates. He says during the recent housing bubble, many homeowners got gouged by brokers.
They made more money when they were able to stick you with a loan that was worse than what you otherwise would have qualified for.
And up until now, that's been perfectly legal. So Reingold is happy to see the new rules from the Federal Reserve that will ban brokers from making extra money this way.
It's about time. The April 1st rules, I think, simply will begin to create a place where consumers have a better chance of not being cheated in the consumer marketplace when they're buying a mortgage.
But many mortgage brokers, as you might imagine, see all this a little bit differently.
People say that, oh, it's a kickback. Well, it really isn't a kickback.
Robert Petrelli is the owner of Mount Vernon Mortgage Company, which is located south of Boston. He's been in the banking and mortgage business since 1971, and he's a former president of the state's mortgage broker trade group.
So here's a rate sheet from one of the major banks out there.
At his desk, Petrelli explains how mortgage brokers make their money. Brokers like him get a wholesale price for a loan from a bank. And it's basically the same way retail shoe stores or grocery stores pay wholesale prices.
It's just wholesale prices versus retail prices. We get a wholesale price versus getting the actual retail price when you go into the shop.
To stay in business, he has to charge something extra to cover his overhead and make a living. In the mortgage business, that's called a yield spread premium, and that's what's being regulated in these new rules. But Petrelli says there's nothing inherently wrong with it. It's really just like a shoe store might get its shoes for $50 and charge a customer $60.
To be able to operate profitably.
So what you're saying is it's actually the building blocks of how reputable, honest mortgage brokers make their money.
Absolutely, positively, 100% correct.
Petrelli says some brokers clearly overcharge their customers, but these new rules will change the way this entire industry gets paid. And many in the business say the new rules aren't fair. Mike Anderson is the head of government affairs for the National Association of Mortgage Brokers.
If this goes through on April 1st, there will be a tremendous amount of layoffs. We are hearing from mortgage brokers across the country that they're going to let all their loan officers go and become a one-man shop.
Anderson says in writing the new rules, the Federal Reserve has favored big banks at the expense of small mortgage broker businesses. He says the big banks will be allowed more flexibility in what they can charge customers, but he says mortgage brokers will be locked into a set profit margin that will tie their hands and make it hard to compete. He says it'll even be hard for them to lower their fees for customers.
Imagine that you and I are both Ford dealerships, and we're both selling Ford F-150 pickups. And we're across the street from one another. What if I could lower my price every day, but you were not allowed to lower your price? It's not going to be long before you go out of business, Chris. The winners in this rule are going to be the big banks. The losers will be the mortgage brokers.
Consumer advocates say that Anderson is exaggerating. Still, Anderson's trade group has filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Federal Reserve, seeking an injunction to postpone the new rules. But unless a judge intervenes, the new rules are set to go into effect this Friday. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
In the world of business, CEOs come and go, but some CEOs go and come back. Think of Steve Jobs, who came back to rescue Apple. And when the giant coffee shop chain Starbucks was faltering in 2008, its former CEO came back.
We needed to go back to the core principles of our company, which was really based on a passionate commitment to source and roast the highest quality coffee in the world and deliver it perfectly to our customers. And I didn't think we were doing that as well at the time as we did in the past.
Howard Schultz is still CEO of the company. He has a new book out called Onward, How Starbucks Fought for Its Life Without Losing Its Soul. He joined us to talk about how fixing the company meant changes, right down to how baristas steam the milk.
you don't want to re-steam milk when you're making a perfect shot of espresso. You want to make a perfect shot of espresso, steam the milk, and if you have anything left over, just pour it out and make another great cappuccino or a cafe latte. That's an example. And I think we were doing things like that, which produced a higher yield or higher profitability, but I just felt it wasn't consistent with the commitment we've always had about making the perfect shot of espresso. It's things like that.
I know that some of the things that you tried, you've pulled back on, like, for example, breakfast sandwiches. I liked your breakfast sandwiches. I have to say, I thought they were awfully good.
Well, the breakfast sandwiches were selling extremely well, but at the time, there was an aroma in the stores that I felt was kind of diluting the integrity of the coffee romance and the aroma of coffee. So we took the breakfast sandwiches out.
You're talking what? You're talking bacon, cheese or something?
Yeah, bacon, cheese sandwiches, things of that nature. We took them out and reconfigured how we're going to do that and then brought them back less than a year later, and they've been more successful now than ever before.
When you look at Starbucks, though, aren't you really basically looking at a huge chain like McDonald's? You want every Starbucks to be like every other Starbucks. And it seems to me it would be impossible to do that without losing a little bit of that coffee experience.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. And the question I think you have to ask yourself is, can something get big and stay small? And I would submit that over the years, we've demonstrated really an unusual ability to create intimacy with both our people and, most importantly, our customers. And unlike McDonald's, Starbucks is not in the fast food business, and we're not a franchise system. We own and operate our stores. And I also go back to the fact that, not unlike the English pub in the UK, Starbucks really has created something quite important in America and now around the world, and that is this third place between home and work, an extension of people's lives at a time when people have no place to go.
Starbucks made a huge point of offering health care to all of its employees, even the part-time employees, and obviously the costs have gone up and up and up. As you move ahead, what's your feeling about health care? Do you think the new health care bill is going to help you or hurt you? Or are you going to be able to keep doing this?
Last year, we spent over $250 million on insuring our people because of health care costs. We've been doing that for almost 20 years and have faced double-digit increases almost every year. There was tremendous pressure on us to eliminate that benefit during the recession, and it's something we would not do despite the economic environment. Going forward, we are deeply committed to maintaining that benefit, and we'll continue to do so. As we approach 2014 and the health care bill becomes law, I would hope that there would be some refinements in which the mandates that are in place would be looked at in a way that would not penalize those companies that are doing the right thing.
What's the change you want?
Well, I think specifically, as the bill is currently written, as I understand it, there are mandates that will increase the cost of covering our existing employees.
Such as?
A good example of that is a certain person at Starbucks may decide, if he or she is 22 or 25 years old, that their parents' health care is better, or they're more inclined to accept that. In the new bill, we would be mandated, whether they wanted to or not, to cover that employee. That doesn't seem to be the right thing at all.
So if Starbucks comes to a point where you feel it's really rock and roll again.
Oh, it is rock and roll again.
Okay. So are you thinking maybe you'll go on a nice long trip or climb a mountain or something, retire again?
Well, I think over the last 3 years, we've completely transformed the company, and the health of Starbucks, I think, is quite good. But I don't think this is a time to celebrate or run some victory lap. We've got a lot of work to do, and I'm deeply committed to our company and our shareholders and have no intent in the short term of leaving.
In the short term?
In the short term.
Mr. Schultz, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Howard Schultz, he is the CEO of Starbucks. And his new book is called Onward, How Starbucks Fought for Its Life Without Losing Its Soul.
Spring is a mean season for high school seniors. It's college acceptance time. And if students don't get in, they never find out why.
Was it that C in Algebra 1, the lukewarm recommendation, the essay that should have gone through spell check?
NPR's Tovia Smith got a rare chance to sit in on an admissions committee at Amherst College in Massachusetts. The liberal arts college will accept only 1,000 of the more than 8,000 students who applied.
High school kids may imagine the admissions officials deciding their fate as a bunch of tweedy old academics in spectacles and suits. But if you got in to watch them work, as I did at Amherst College, you might be surprised to find how much they look like students cramming for finals.
I never want to see another cookie as long as I live.
About a dozen committee members squeeze around a table covered with candy wrappers, coffee cups, and their massive loose-leaf binders of Amherst hopefuls.
So we're going to start on page 522.
This is the final stretch of the selection process. 85% of applicants have already been weeded out. Only the creme de la creme get presented to the full committee.
Grade. He's a valedictorian. He started taking APs his freshman year. Fives in world history, bio, and U.S. history.
Committee member Christina Nieves is one of two readers assigned to pore over this application and reduce it to the one-page, one-minute, rapid-fire review she presents to the rest of the committee.
Vice president of the National Math Honor Society. He's part of the Math League and the Chess Club. He's a tutor, a lab assistant, does community service.
After giving his vitals, she also offers a few impressionistic notes on the student and his essays.
He writes a touching E1 about his work in pediatrics at a hospital. Overall, I like him.
Clearly a superstar.
Alrighty, except.
But he gets not a single vote and instead ends up on the wait list.
I think the process to anybody who is not inside it is baffling. It's perplexing.
Amherst Dean of Admissions Tom Parker is the first to concede the absurdity of passing on such stellar students.
It's just that these kids look remarkably similar, and we're making nuanced judgments. None of us are going to pretend that that's exact science. You know, it's a flawed process.
I like him. I thought he was pretty cool.
And it's a highly subjective one, where decisions can turn on as little as one line in an essay.
He said, when my parents and doctors simultaneously asked how I was feeling, only two words came out of my mouth, chicken McNuggets.
This one will fly, but another student's essay read by Dean Kathleen Mayberry will prove fatal.
I'm troubled by one sentence in the first essay. I rarely get truly fascinated with a subject. And then he goes on, music is his exception.
What am I supposed to do with that?
My jaw dropped. I mean, that was flabbergasting.
Intellectual passion is a must, says Parker. The students who get in are the ones who come across as genuine. It also helps to come across as different.
Vice president of the Jewish club, president of the Japanese society, an active member of the Muslim club, and lastly, an observant of Hindu traditions.
If you read it, it's not gimmicky. I mean, this is a kid who's interested in all of that stuff.
The committee buys it, and the kid gets in. What's surprising is how much is consensus and how much everyone relies on the vibe they get from the two initial readers.
Overall, a great young woman, obviously a strong student, but I feel like I'm missing something.
You know, to make it through, you've got to have genuine enthusiasm from the readers, and it wasn't there.
Just missing that je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's the appropriate phrase, because you can't quite name it.
One committee member calls it the magic, another the soul. We're trying to separate the James Browns from the James Taylors, he says, and it's a daunting task.
Last night I was up, and I was just like, wow, and I had a hard time sleeping, to be honest with you.
Associate Dean Dale Hendricks says the responsibility is overwhelming.
You just feel bad. And you feel like there's probably something you could have said or done to, you know, whatever, sway the committee or something like that. But if it's just not there, it's not there.
I think this is one of those cases that we may not feel compelled to consider further.
Even for a veteran like Kathleen Mayberry, the emotion runs deep.
It's harder than it looks. I don't think people really realize that.
You're getting emotional.
I am. I'm sorry. I think kids are important.
Mayberry says she's especially moved by stories of disadvantaged kids who might have few other options. Amherst calls itself Need Affirmative. It gives preferential treatment to kids who are first in their family to go to college or poor. The SP31s, as they're called in admissions code, face a lower bar, like this kid being presented by Dean Parker.
I get an offbeat sort of bohemian sense here. He's a thinker and a seeker. Still, it will be the SB31 that will make the difference, except with it, wait list without.
All right, so we're going to vote. Accept. 1, 2, 3, 4. My recommendation is this is one we should set aside.
In some cases, if it's a split decision, there can be kind of gasps or there appears to be real pain.
Parker says those applications can be set aside both to spare one member's feelings and to protect the committee as a whole.
You can end up with one group pitted against another group and, you know, with people voting spitefully. Oh, so you don't support mine? No, tomorrow I'll have my chance. It's a human tendency.
This year, none of the set-asides will make it. There are already too many in the yes pile, and members will soon have to make the really impossible decisions to pull some out.
There is going to come a point where it's going to be very close to, you know, closing your eyes and doing that, because we're exhausting the meaningful criteria to separate John from Mary. For that group, it's effectively a lottery. It really is.
Parker concedes it's a disturbing notion to many high achievers, but in an odd way, he hopes it may also be a kind of relief to kids to know that the decision is a little random and not a referendum on their worth. It's kind of like that old breakup line, "It's not you, it's me."
Yes, indeed. There are years that it's great to be a runner, and there are years that it's great to be a lacrosse player, and there are years that it's great to play the piccolo, and there are great years that it's great to play the piano. But the candidate doesn't know that.
Parker will spend most of the next month trying to reassure kids a rejection is not the end of the world.
Hard as it is to imagine, it is going to be okay. I mean, you know, I've had the great privilege of turning down at least one Rhodes Scholar.
That's it, folks.
Good job, guys.
When decisions are finally done, the irony is not lost on Parker that the tables will totally turn. As he puts it, these kids that we've been tormenting now have 3 or 4 acceptance letters, and now we have to wait to see if they'll accept us. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
It's 8 o'clock at night. You have a stack of dirty dishes in the sink, a pile of paperwork on your desk, and your kids want you to read to them. Guess what? There's an app for that. Okay, not the dishes, but you can download a children's book app to your smartphone or iPad. Enhanced children's e-books include narration, animation, and interactive features. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some kids are getting their very first exposure to books on a digital device.
Michelle Kripalani is deeply invested in Dr. Seuss these days for 2 reasons. His company, Ocean House Media, has the rights to develop the works of Dr. Seuss as digital books, everything from Green Eggs and Ham to The Cat in the Hat. Kripalani also has a 2-year-old daughter, Kentia, who loves Dr. Seuss, especially on her father's iPad.
Boy, she can navigate on that thing. It's incredible. There's something about a child's ability to navigate by touching what they want. And I believe that's the magic here. It's just that the child is able to touch the tree or touch the bird or touch the word that they don't know. And that's really one of the things that just changes everything.
What's that?
The kitty, kitty. Can you touch the cat?
Cat.
Good job.
Meow.
No, Pat.
Kripalani doesn't consider himself an expert on reading. He began his career as a video game developer. But he says his team was very aware that Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, cared deeply about literacy. So in developing digital versions of books like The Cat in the Hat, they wanted to use the interactive features to help children learn to read.
And as the app is reading the book, the individual words are highlighting. So the child is getting an association between what they're hearing and the actual word that's being spoken at the time. Or they can also touch on any of the pictures, and they get a picture-word association. So if the child taps on cat, for example, the letters C-A-T float up, and the narrator speaks in a clear voice, cat.
With the ebook market so hot right now, a lot of people are eager to get in on the ground floor. Rick Richter left the traditional publishing world to found Ruckus Media, which develops digital versions of well-known kids' books, as well as brand new book apps like A Present for Milo.
What a 2 to 4 year old wants in an app really is to poke and be satisfied and really a very high degree of interactivity. So Milo has 80 different touch points and 125 different animations. And they're randomized, of course, so every time the child enters, it's a different experience.
A present for Milo begins simply enough with a story about a cat and a mouse.
Who's there, there, there? Milo, that's who! And away they go.
Words appear as the narrator speaks them, and illustrations come alive when touched. A mouse squeaks. A plane flies. A piano plays. Other book apps developed by Ruckus are less interactive, but they might offer other options, substituting a well-known actor's narration with a parent's voice, for example. Richter believes these apps are an entirely new art form.
People ask us, are you creating books? Are you creating games? Are you creating, you know, animations? The answer is yes. And that's what we set out to do. Books you can play with and games you can read.
But as you might expect, for some, an app will always be just an app.
It's not a book for a number of reasons.
Philip Nell is a professor of English and director of the Children's Literature Program at Kansas State University.
One is that in a traditional reading experience, the reader is in charge. The reader acts on the book. With the interactive ebook, the reader does still act on the book, but the book also acts on, and depending on the adaptation, sometimes against the reader. So I would say that it's not a book. It's maybe a relative of the book, but it's not quite a book.
Nell agrees with Richter that these apps are something entirely different. He says highlighting the words can be helpful to a young reader, but he thinks some of the sound effects and interactive features may interfere with the process of reading.
Reading may be involved, but there's more to it than that, and it's different than that. It's, you know, we don't read a film, we watch a film. We don't read a video game, we play a video game. And I was trying to think, what's the verb to describe what the enhanced ebook experience is like? Is it work? Is it use? Do we play an enhanced ebook?
It's true that some of the bells and whistles in kids' book apps can be distracting, says Elizabeth Bird. She's a librarian at the New York Public Library who's come up with some criteria for evaluating children's book apps. She says it's important that all the artwork and interactive features in an app are well integrated with the story. Obviously, not all apps are equal, says Bird, but the ones that get it right can take a book to a new level.
They allow you to do things that you really couldn't do before. For example, there's a wonderful Peter Rabbit app that's out right now, which sort of turns Peter Rabbit into a virtual pop-up book. And you can go beyond that. I mean, there are apps where you can touch a word, it will pronounce it for you, but it can pronounce it for you in any language. So you could learn a language a second way by using one of these picture book apps.
Bird doesn't believe apps are about to overtake books. She says kids move seamlessly back and forth between traditional print books and digital books all the time. And if a parent wants to use a book app to distract a child, well, Bird doesn't see a problem with that either.
Let's say that I'm in a grocery store and I see a parent handing their phone to their child. Do I want them to hand the child a game like Angry Birds, or do I want them to hand them Freight Train by Donald Cruise in the app form? I would prefer that they hand them the book.
Kids' book apps are so new, says Michelle Cripollani, it's not surprising there are problems still to be resolved. But when he thinks about his daughter, those questions go away.
I just stand back in awe, and I just say, wow, she is just going to be able to absorb so much faster, so much earlier. It's really, really awe-inspiring when you see a, you know, 3 or 4 year old child that really gets it.
And of course, just like a good old-fashioned book, an app works best when a parent and child enjoy it together.
Cynthia, can you touch the puppy?
Pup.
Can you touch the cup?
Cup.
Good job.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And for links to download A Present for Milo, The Cat in the Hat, and the other apps we just heard about, visit npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
College basketball is known for the March Madness brackets, but not for obsessive statistics keepers. That's usually baseball's territory. Well, Ken Pomeroy is trying to change that. He runs the free website kenpom.com. And if you want to know the offensive rebound percentage for any NCAA player or a team's turnover percentage, he's your guy. Ken Pomeroy is also a meteorologist in Salt Lake City, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's take a look at your rankings for the final four NCAA teams. You have Kentucky, Connecticut, Butler, and VCU ranked respectively at number 4, 11, 37, and 50. Does that mean that your rankings are out of whack with what we've seen in the tournament?
Well, it certainly speaks to the fact that the final four is extremely unusual this year. I think most of the time you'd find teams in the top 20 that are in the final four. Rarely would a team be outside the top 20 at this point in the season, because you got to think about it. VCU, they're ranked 50th, and they've already played five games where they've looked pretty good, and they're still only ranked 50th, so they had to come a long way just to get to that point.
Well, tell us about the statistics that you keep an especially close eye on to try to help you understand teams.
The two big ones are offensive and defensive efficiency, which I put on the front page of my site, and those basically measure what a team does when they have the basketball. Are they effective at scoring, or are they effective at preventing scoring? Those are kind of the two cornerstones of analyzing what a team does well and what they don't do well and why they're successful or not.
You're going to have to explain to me how you have a statistic in there for luck.
What luck measures is how a team performs in close games. And if you've watched any of the college basketball action over the past couple of weeks, you've seen some weird things happen in close games, things that are outside of a team's control a lot of times. I mean, players make clutch shots. You know, they do things to win games at the end, obviously. But there are also some things out of their control. Officiating is one of those things that is pretty often cited. And so if a team wins a lot of close games, chances are they've had some good fortune at the end of games. And that's really what luck tries to quantify.
Is there, when you think about the Final Four, is there one player that you're going to especially be keeping your eye on who the numbers seem to say there's something really great going on here?
There's one guy in particular that comes to mind, and that's Josh Harrelson of Kentucky. He's an interesting guy because he's got this odd affinity for wearing jean shorts. So he has the nickname Jorts, which endears him to a lot of fans.
Doesn't show up in your statistics.
Not at all. And you don't normally see a guy who likes jorts actually be a great basketball player. There's not a lot of crossover there. But in the case of Josh Harrelson, he actually has turned into a very good player. He's a role player for Kentucky. They have players that are going to go higher in the NBA draft. But he's outstanding in his role. He has a very high offensive rating. So when he touches the basketball, he does good things with it. And he's also very good at offensive rebounding. So I measure something called offensive rebounding percentage. And he grabs one out of every six Kentucky misses. So normally, Melissa, a missed shot is a bad thing, but Harrelson actually, you know, makes it not a bad thing by grabbing the rebound, giving his teammates an opportunity to take another shot, which has really helped Kentucky's offense be actually very, very good this season.
Well, based on your numbers and the way you've crunched them, when you look at the Final Four, who would you say wins the NCAA championship this year?
The thing is, you know, as things were progressing over the last weekend, the favorite to win the tournament changed from Ohio State. They lost and went to Kansas. They ended up losing. It went to UConn, and then Kentucky ended up winning, and they became the favorite. So it's changed hands four times in the last 3 days or so. But Kentucky's the best team. I actually have them at about a 45% chance to win the tournament. So that, of course, means there's a 55% chance that they don't. So there's still plenty of time for upsets to occur here, even though there's only three games left.
Ken Pomeroy, NCAA statistician by night and meteorologist by day. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
And now, let's move up to your back. Some researchers say a non-medical remedy for back pain can be effective. It's a series of posture lessons called the Alexander Technique. Sarah Varney of member station KQED in San Francisco has more.
Those bright, powerful notes from the revival of a chorus line are a lot of work, and hitting those notes night after night in a cramped orchestra pit takes a toll on the musicians.
The fact of having your arms up, carrying the weight of this instrument, and pushing the instrument towards you. And so you have this stress, you have this sort of wall that you're pushing against, and a well-designed instrument will sort of push back.
If you ever saw Wicked in San Francisco or Cats on the Road, you've probably heard Joe Rodriguez blasting on his trumpet. I met him at the Musicians Union Hall in downtown San Francisco. He's been a working trumpet player for 4 decades, and all that back arching and shoulder pinching has left him with chronic pain in his lower back. He tried massage, chiropractic, and powerful painkillers, but he says it was only through Alexander Technique lessons did he train his body to move in a way that eased his aching back.
It's a feeling of working with yourself from the inside out. If you know that you're twisting a certain way or using too much force, it's easy enough to know, let that go.
I wasn't really sure what Joe meant, so we took a listen to one of his trumpet solos.
And talk about how, when you're doing this kind of solo, how you're holding yourself differently now because of learning the Alexander Technique.
Now I know that I can just sort of be, so what they call under sits bones on the hip, you know, instead of maybe some funny arch or with my stomach pushed out or my back arched some strange way.
We're just going to let the neck be free here. Let the head move forward and up and yes.
I'm on my hands and knees next to Josephine Gray, trying to relearn how to stand up. Jo, as she likes to be called, teaches the technique and says low back pain is a common complaint of clients.
We would look at what you are doing that causes that problem in the first place. How you sit at the computer or how you pick up your child or what you're doing when you're driving. I definitely look at ways of changing your postural habits so that you don't get into pain.
These aren't static postures, though. Those who promote the technique say it's more about how you move and training yourself to release tension. These are subtle, tiny, almost imperceptible shifts. And although the teacher will put her hand on your neck or shoulder, it's more to bring awareness than to make adjustments.
No, the whole point is that you understand the process so that you can arrive there yourself.
Mm-hmm. Joe the teacher and Joe the trumpet player both say the lessons are no cure-all, but there is evidence it can ease chronic low back pain over the long run. Paul Little is a primary care researcher at the University of Southampton in Britain. He led a study of some 460 patients who were given Alexander lessons or massage or the usual care of painkillers and exercise. After a year, those who had massage were no better off. Those who had 6 Alexander lessons showed some improvement, and those who went the distance got the best results.
The people who'd had 24 lessons had gone down from about 21 days in pain that the usual care group reported to about 3 days in pain. So a really dramatic difference there in reported days in pain.
Little's research was published in the British Medical Journal in 2008, but now he wants to figure out why it appears to work. He's about to start a new study that involves giving chronic back pain sufferers lessons in the Alexander technique and exercises, and then measuring how far their spines can twist and the size and strength of their deep lumbar muscles, which Little thinks might work poorly in people with chronic low back pain. He cautions, though, that it may be something else entirely that accounts for the apparent success of the Alexander technique. If that's the case, Little says he'll have to go back to the drawing board. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.